It's lovely to be with you again speaking. To begin, I'd like to acknowledge that we're on Whadjuk Noongar land and acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land and their elders, past, present and emerging. And particularly this week, I wanted to acknowledge the injustice that Noongar people have suffered and continue to experience, and to both acknowledge and lament the at least 432 Aboriginal people who have died in police custody in the 30 years since the Royal Commission. That's the context in which we always speak, and I want to acknowledge that and stand there. So today I'm talking about Tabitha, and she's not a very well-known biblical character, and that's possibly because her story is tucked in between two of the smash hit tales of the New Testament, really. You've got Paul's conversion on the Damascus Road, and then you've got the story of Peter and Cornelius, where the vision of the unclean food being clean revolutionizes the church and turns a Jewish church into a church open to others. And tucked in between these two stories is Tabitha. So perhaps it's not that surprising that we don't know her very well. Why is she there at all? And why is she in such an odd place? Are two of the questions I want to look at. But before I talk about that, I want to just talk briefly about miraculous healing, because Tabitha is brought back to life, and it's a paired story with the healing of Aeneas, who is a lame man who is lifted into walking. But we know, and we know painfully so, that healing miracles are rare. I don't think they were the norm in the early church either. Because if they were the norm, the people of Joppa would not have needed to call Peter in. They would have just done a quick miracle healing and got back to work. If it was commonplace for people to come back from the dead, if it was commonplace for lame people to get up and walk, we wouldn't have a group of widows accompanying Tabitha, because every widow is somebody who has experienced loss and grief and who has not experienced a miracle healing. So if the norm is as we know the norm, then why does God sometimes allow miracle healings? We don't know. That is a question we cannot answer. All we can do is acknowledge that when we talk about miraculous healings, for most people, and that includes most of us, we live with the pain of frailty and loss and not the astonishment of a miraculous healing. So before we enter into this, what is sacred ground to talk about healings, let's all just take a minute to pause and acknowledge all the grief of those without a miracle. Why is this story told? It's probably told to tell us something about the way the early church developed, and particularly Acts is always concerned with the way God has worked amongst early Christians to bring the church into being. For any of us who struggle with the science of a miracle healing, you don't need to take this story literally to hear the story of how God works in the early church. The core message in Acts is resurrection. Jesus, they believe, is the Jewish Messiah, and the way they know this is because Jesus has been revealed to his followers beyond death. And therefore, the identity of Jesus' followers is an identity of resurrection. Nothing, not even death, is stronger than the love and life that Jesus has introduced them to. Now, the followers talk on and on, sometimes for whole chapters at a time. They talk about resurrection. But here, they have temporarily stopped talking and they enact resurrection. In some ways, twice, because the story of Aeneas uses resurrection language. Aeneas, the lame man, is told to rise from your bed, rise. It's the same language of resurrection. Okay, but why put that story where it is? Because it risks being totally overshadowed in the location it's in. Most commentators will say that these healing stories are there to show that Peter's the real deal. Because in his encounter with Cornelius, which is what's coming next, Peter says things that are extremely challenging to his church. Who is Peter to suggest that God would speak to him directly about changing the entire social and legal framework of the believing community, changing the whole structure of who is the people of God. This is a very big claim to be making. Who is Peter to say that? And so here are stories to show Peter as being in the line of the great prophets and servants of God. The language is very clearly imitating stories of Elijah and Elisha in healing, and of course stories of Jesus. You will have recognized the echoes of stories of where Jesus heals a lame man, where Jesus goes into the upper room and heals a little girl using the word Talitha, which is very nearly Tabitha. The passage here in Acts is very careful to make sure that it is the power of God that raises, not the power of Peter. But nevertheless, this is saying Peter's really important and Peter's legitimate. So if Peter says he has an experience of God that reveals God has no favourites, which is in chapter 10, then you'd better believe him. Now, we no longer put a resurrection story and a miracle healing into our accounts in order to prove that someone is worth listening to. But we do still have an internal compass of what we need to have proven before we'll listen to someone. So just take a minute for yourself. What sort of evidence do you require if you're going to take seriously someone who challenges your preconceptions? Perhaps someone who challenges your privilege. Peter and Paul were challenging the privilege of Jewish believers. All of that is true, but the problem with this interpretation is that it makes the story all about Peter. But the author's giving a surprising amount of detail about Tabitha if she's actually incidental to the main point. For a start, she's given a name. Now, in the Bible, if people are given a name, it's usually a flag to take notice. And Tabitha's not only given a name, her name is also translated into a second language. It's possible that Tabitha is a bridge story between the Jewish and the Gentile worlds. We've just had Paul, the iconic converted Jew, and we're about to have Cornelius, the poster boy for converted Gentiles. Tabitha, whose name means gazelle, is named both in Aramaic, Tabitha, and in Greek, Dorcas. To me, Dorcas doesn't sound very gazelle-like, but that could be my Australian ears. She's in Joppa. Joppa is a multicultural port city right on the edge of the Jewish world. Maybe she's known by two names because she already ministers to both Jewish and non-Jewish people. So her story opens the way for this radical Gentile inclusion that we're about to get when Peter encounters Cornelius. That's still a story that largely points to Peter. How does this story look if we put Tabitha in the middle rather than Peter? Now, there are lots of sermons on the web where they respond to this text by praising the devout domestic work of women, that this domestic labour of women is laudable service of God. Tabitha's contribution to her community is described in the text as sewing clothes. And she's also described as a disciple, a word that's used elsewhere for an inner circle of followers. And she appears to be given very high praise and the language of discipleship for doing the things that women of her time did, and many still are confined to doing, things that were considered appropriate women's work. There are a lot of speeches in Acts, and all the words, all the proclaiming gospel in words is in the mouths of men. But Tabitha shows another way of faithful service. She does the things that she was good at, the things that were within her sphere, and she does them with love and compassion rather than with preaching. I do not want to in any way undervalue this kind of work, because the church has relied really heavily on the unpaid, unacknowledged practical labours of women since the get-go. The accolades, the ordination tends to go to the pastors, the preachers, the scholars, the leaders, and often not so noticed is the enabling works of cooking and cleaning and sewing. And none of those are things I love to do. And I'm very, very grateful for all of those who offer that sort of undervalued work into the life of the church. Take a moment to think of your own life and to recognize and thank God for the people in our church, in your families, and in your church of origin who quietly give or have given practical service outside the recognized roles. And I am honored to give thanks to God for my mum who's with us this morning. You know, I'm going to cry. I didn't mean to do that. who has given her whole life to practical service without a recognized role and is a tremendous role model to me and to many others of this kind of discipleship. Who is it in your life? These things are worth celebrating, but I also think there is more in this text. Tabitha is involved in a ministry to widows. Now, in chapter 6 of Acts, the church in Jerusalem hits a crisis because the leaders are accused of being unjust in the way they care for widows. And so the apostles appoint 7 men to oversee charitable distribution to the widows. The men, the apostles claim that their own work of prayer and leadership, they actually say this, I'm not making this up, they say their own work of prayer and leadership is too important for them to do the ministry to widows. So they appoint some other men to do that. Now, I don't think it's a coincidence that 3 chapters later, we are shown a community that seems to have got that issue sorted out on their own without apostolic intervention. Tabitha appears to have been the leader to oversee this work, and she has done it in a way that didn't cause division and conflict, but that made her beloved to her community. In fact, she is so important that when she dies, they send for Peter the Apostle to come. Now, I don't think they called for Peter because they expected he would bring her back from the dead. I think they called for him because he was the appropriate person to oversee the funeral of someone who was such a pillar of their church. And he comes at once because he recognizes her significance. Because she's in an upper room, it's often assumed that Tabitha was moderately wealthy, and so that she acted as a sort of a patron. If Tabitha's discipleship comprises her using her wealth and privately sewing clothes to be charitably distributed to the poor, then we have a model of discipleship that is very comfortable for white middle-class women. We have charity, but we don't have justice. We need to not stop there. How might Tabitha be read by marginalized women? And by marginalized men, but I'm particularly interested in this story of women today. What do you see if you enter this story alongside the poorest characters in it, rather than alongside Peter? What do you see if you enter this story alongside marginalized women in our world now? Perhaps walk into this story. I'm going to ask us to imagine this place and this story now and walk into this room, into this story, in the company of someone at the margins. Maybe someone who's in the story, or maybe someone from our world. Maybe a woman who's living with domestic violence. Maybe a black woman whose son has been murdered by the police. Maybe someone who cannot feed her children. What do we see then when we walk into the story of Tabitha? And you will see different things to me, and that might be a space for conversation over coffee. But some of the things that I have seen, or people I've been reading this week have seen, some have suggested that Tabitha headed up a formal religious order of widows. Some of these were known in the early church world. Widows is sometimes used as a kind of generic term for single women, because I didn't have any other way to conceptualize you might actually be a single woman unless your bloke had died. So, however people came to the status of being single, they were sometimes referred to as women. Possibly this collective of women was together running a clothing business. So sewing together, not recipients of Tabitha's charity, but part of a group working together. Perhaps Tabitha has responded to the needs of widows by organising a cooperative so that they're lifted out of poverty by their shared work. And the femaleness of this community is emphasised by the washing of Tabitha's body. This is a task only women could do. And it reminds us that she has a body and that that is a woman's body. Now, people who talk about women in the stories of Luke Acts note that Luke, the author of Acts, is at odds with his cultural context because the world around him refers to women in terms of their relationship with a man. They're a wife, they're a daughter, they're an employee, they're a slave of. But Luke refers to women in terms of their relationship with God. They're believers, they're followers, or sometimes they're opponents, but they're who they are is defined by their relationship with God. And yet the same commentators who make this point, without blinking, assume that Tabitha must have been a widow because there's no husband mentioned. What matters about Tabitha and how she's described is her discipleship, her care of the poor, not her marital status. That's irrelevant. And the fact that commentators still assume she must be a widow shows us how far we still have to go. Peter was on a pastoral tour of the communities outside Jerusalem, and they're all founded by others. We're not told who they're founded by. Most of the commentators assume that these are communities founded by Philip, who we're told after the death of Stephen leaves Jerusalem and does missionary journeys around the Jewish towns. If this is true, it's interesting to note that Philip is one of the seven men appointed to look after widows in Acts chapter 6. Did his missionary work involve the care of widows as part of the core of the gospel? But why do we assume the church was founded by Philip? And here we need to check our lens, because our lens is heavily influenced by the lens of the author. Luke's worldview is centered in the male-led Jerusalem church. And the way he tells the story of the early church assumes that this is the legitimate center and all the other pieces need to be grafted in. And so we tend to do it too, because that's how the story is given to us. And so commentators look for a Jerusalem link to understand how there could be Christians in Lydda and Joppa. But what if these people had encountered Jesus for themselves? It's not that far from Lydda and Joppa to the places Jesus ministered. What if Tabitha heard Jesus speaking and became inspired? Because Tabitha's works look a lot more like the teachings of Jesus than the resurrection gospel that's coming out of Jerusalem. Was she a disciple because she followed her teacher? The meaning of disciple is to follow a teacher. Was she a disciple because she followed her teacher? And that teacher was Jesus, not Philip or Peter. So Tabitha then is not a bridge between Paul and Peter. She is another example of the Holy Spirit raising up followers in unexpected ways and unexpected places. We have Paul, the Jewish persecutor, couldn't be more unexpected. We have Tabitha, the woman founding a community without Jerusalem or male oversight. We have Cornelius, the Roman centurion, who hears God speak. Tabitha's story, then, is not about the healing of Tabitha legitimizing Peter's authority. It's about Peter visiting Tabitha's community to affirm Tabitha's authority. Peter could have done a funeral and quietly shut down this upstart group. But instead, he goes into the room where Tabitha's body lies, makes himself ritually unclean. He says only three words, which in the context of Acts is remarkable because sometimes he'll speak a whole chapter. He puts out his hand, he helps her up, And then he presents her to the widows and the saints, is the words used. Two different categories. Why say widows and saints? Perhaps because the widows is Tabitha's community and the saints are representatives of the wider church. And Peter presents Tabitha to them. One sermon I read online suggested that this is an act akin to ordination, that Peter, the head of the church, anoints Tabitha to continue the ministry of service and leadership that she has been doing. So he raises her up to life, but he also raises her up to leadership. He announces both to her community and to the wider church that she's a legitimate leader, she's a legitimate disciple of Jesus. This is quite similar to the way just a few verses earlier, Barnabas presented Paul to the church in Jerusalem to vouch for him as legitimate. Now, there is a lot of speculation in this interpretation, and I can see that it is likely that Luke intended Tabitha's story primarily to shore up the case for Peter being legitimate when he spoke about the vision with Cornelius. But I also think things get into our sacred texts and lie there waiting for a time when a different lens will see different truths. I think it's time to notice Tabitha and her woman-led church in Joppa, to recognize the wonder of God's Spirit working in places and spaces the majority culture considers outcast, illegitimate, or unworthy of attention. This week, we've particularly been reminded to listen to the voices of people of colour and to pay attention to our own embedded colonial mindset. So a black woman theologian that I read, Will Gaffney, who is marvellous, follow up Will Gaffney if you've got the time. She noted that calling Tabitha Dorcas, the Greek name, is a typical colonial action, to use the colonists' language to name people rather than hearing the name they use for themselves. Has Luke colonized Tabitha's story for his own purposes? And is it now time for us to decolonize and to try and hear her in her own right? There's a lot I've just packed into, not very much time, and there's a lot of that that's theoretical, but I want to ask, what does this mean for us for this week? What are you going to take home from this? Well, you're already at home. What are you going to hold on to in your homes from this? And here's just a couple of thoughts. Something may already have struck your attention. If that's the case, hold on to that and chew it round. But here are some suggestions. If you are someone whose response to Christ is a practical, low-key, unacknowledged work, you are seen. Your work matters. So go on with it, knowing that it is valued by God, it's valued in the life of the church. If you are in a place of grief, loss, or death, and particularly I'm thinking of the Winton family this morning, know that God is somehow a God of life, not instead of death, but through death and beyond death. The God we follow is a God who radically includes outsiders. Whoever you are welcome with God. And whoever you encounter this week, in person or through the news, they are also welcome with God. How can you this week live out of your utter acceptedness? And how can you stretch your welcome to be so accepting to others? This text is a reminder to me to check my lens, to check how I see the world every day, every text, every news article, every conversation. It's exhausting work, and as privileged people, it is our responsibility to do that work. In this text, the lens is Jewish, male, Jerusalem-based leadership. In the conversation you're about to have over coffee, what is your lens? The Spirit of God bubbles up in places we don't expect, and perhaps in ways that make us uncomfortable. This week, Will Gaffney, the theologian I mentioned on her blog for Pentecost last week, talked about the fire of the Holy Spirit, and the picture she used was a picture of a building burning in Minneapolis with Black Lives Matter protesters in front of it. That is not a picture of the Holy Spirit that I find comfortable. How can I pay attention this week? How can you pay attention to where God may be moving in ways that put you outside your comfort zone? Because I believe God is always moving amongst us. So as we step into this week, may we clean our lenses and pay attention so that we don't miss the discomforting challenge and the unconditional embrace of God's Spirit of love. So I'm happy to take questions if people want to take questions, or Rochelle, I'm not sure if you've got something else you're going with next.
No question from me, Claire. I want to thank you for, yes, such a thoughtful, challenging sermon. And I agree with you. And I just add that, of course, the other miracle in this story is the miracle that scaredy cat Peter should be standing in front of there, doing, leading these things. Yeah. Not to take away from anything you've said.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful story.
Yeah. And that's a good reminder of what, in theological terms, is called the dual hermeneutic, that to read a text and notice something like a patriarchal bias doesn't have to mean that we therefore have to chuck out the good news that was embedded in that text, even if it's told in a way we would no longer use.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure, John.
Claire, I'm trying to remember, I haven't got the text in front of me, a little bit before Tabitha's story where about Paul left and then they experienced a time of peace and growth. I thought this added some weight to your interpretation. Let's take the dominant male out and see what we're left with.
Well, there is that, and there are people with a tongue in cheek who say the text is Paul was sent to Tarsus and the church experienced a period of peace, and that once you get rid of Paul, maybe you've got quite a bit of peace. But maybe that's not long-term where we're meant to be going, that sort of peace.
Yeah. Yes, that doesn't mean that his disruption was of no value. But that, yes, perhaps when we have those dominant forces, that then we have to take a step back from them and allow them a time of settling.
Thanks.
Claire? What was that lady's name you mentioned? You said Will Guthrie?
So her first name is W-I-L, Will, and her surname is spelled G-A-F-N-E-Y. She has a blog and she also posts voluminously on Twitter, if that's your means. And she's been on the streets the last 2 weeks with protests in the US. She's in America. She's an Episcopal priest, amongst other things, and a lecturer at a university on Old Testament women, mostly.